What have you noticed with the tone of this year's presidential campaign?
It is notable that, of course, the campaigns try to define themselves. They don't leave it to the media or anybody else to define them, but they do this themselves. And the overwhelming percentage of advertising that's been run by the campaigns and by their allies in the super PAC community has been negative.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. They think that for various reasons, those are more effective, not to necessarily persuade, but to rally their base, to get the people out to vote who they think will support them. And I don't know if you had a chance to hear yesterday's program. We were talking with Ari Shapiro about the work he did out in Colorado Springs and the targeting of these ads, where the Obama campaign will have 20 different advertisements all up at the same time. This one on Spike TV aimed at young men, this one on Lifetime aimed for women, and the sophistication is just that's remarkable.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. In Kentucky, we often feel that we're not necessarily part of the ad conversation because
you should be lucky. Yes.
Well, I wanted to discuss that a little bit with you because so we're left out of that, and because you have callers every day that I'm sure talk to you about what it's like to be in Ohio, to be in Colorado. And what do you think it's like on their perspective? Is this a positive thing? Do you think it actually changes their opinion of candidates? Is it effective, do you think?
I think ultimately it's corrosive.
Corrosive.
I think it undermines faith in government. I think it undermines faith in politics. I think it undermines faith in democratic institutions. It works. That's why they do it. But I think it's corrosive.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Talk of the Nation as a program, which follows, in a sense, a very traditional format of radio, which is it's a call-in show.
Yeah.
And there have been call-in shows for years, and oftentimes we see call-in shows that are maybe very to the left, very much to the right, yet you have had to carve out a very specific place for yourself, and that's in the neutral spot, in the middle. How have you managed to do that over the past, how many years it's been now since you've been hosting?
11 years since I've been hosting, and it is due to the training I've had my whole life as a journalist. Learning the same principles as a reporter, you apply those to your job as the host of a radio call-in show, and you work hard to balance issues. There are any number of issues where there's a lot more than two sides, and there's some issues where there's only one. So you have to be intellectually honest with yourself. You have to try to look for balance in advance. But the interesting part about live radio is you can go in with the greatest plan in the world and the first guest opens their mouth or the first caller comes in and your plan goes out the window because it's gone off in a different direction. And then you have to be light on your feet and try to bring it around to cover the things that you want to cover in more or less the spaces that you would like to cover them. And one of the things we focus on is that stories have a beginning and a middle and an end. Mm. And what we try to do is tell stories. We are sophisticated storytellers, specialized storytellers, but we're still telling stories, and they still have beginnings, middles, and ends. And we changed the default question on the program several years ago from join the conversation to tell us your story. Mm. Because what we want to hear from callers is not their necessarily their opinion on the Middle East or their opinion on Afghanistan, but what in their experience in their life led them to such a belief, so that if you served two terms in Helmand, you got an interesting perspective on the situation where we're not joint patrolling with Afghans anymore.
Well, it's interesting how you talk about this issue of a story, yet dealing with the complication of a live format where, as you say, things can go in very different directions very quickly. How do you craft a story when you don't know what's coming in front of you?
Well, you try to prepare in advance. You try to be fluent with the issues so you can speak to them. And as people talk, this is something I learned from the mother of us all, Susan Stamberg. I used to be terrified as a younger person. What am I going to ask next? What comes up next?
Right.
What am I supposed to ask? And I would be so nervous about looking at my sheets and my prepared questions. She explained to me, and it took many years for this to sink in from intellectual understanding to actual practice, if you just listen carefully, the guest will tell you what the next question is.
Yeah. What about this trend, as we were talking about earlier, that there has been the rise of the Fox Newses, there has been the rise of the MSNBCs, of the shows where people call in, and people call them echo chambers sometimes, where they just want to hear what they care about. In the last 11 years, as you've been hosting, Have you noticed, though, a change in what people expect from a call-in show? Do you think people, you know, especially in Talk of the Nation, do you think it's been harder to have that kind of a civil dialogue in the middle?
No, I don't. I think it's, you know, there are certain issues that it's no easier on today. Abortion, gun control, the Middle East, you can pick them out. If you're doing opinion shows, they're very difficult to get people to talk about changing their minds because people's minds are made up. So, you know, yeah, those shows are going to be difficult. So what we try to do is find different ways to frame the conversation so that we can hear people's stories about their life experiences rather than their opinions on this or that, which are pretty well formed and frankly not all that interesting because there's only three or four of them that most people tend to have. So it's not been difficult, I don't think. I think people are refreshed by the opportunity to have a real conversation, to explore issues in depth, to get past the superficialities. And one of the glories of the format is you have these big chunks of time, 12 minutes in the first segment, I'm sure, as you know, 18 and a half in the next two. So 17 and a half in the second one. Anyway, I was getting into technicalities,
right.
But be that as it may. We were able to have this conversation the other day with Rob Gifford, our former China correspondent, now The Economist, and a gentleman named Christopher Smith, who's the former senior CIA China analyst. And he said it was such a pleasure to be able to get, you know, back and forth, to go over issues, to get in depth in time so that, you know, these are not to go into even a building like NPR and not to be talking in sound bites.
Right. Do you feel that space that we're talking about, that you try and cultivate on that show, is that a space that you do feel is being attacked or it's a shrinking space?
No, I don't think it's being attacked. I think there is this belief that people have shorter attention spans and will listen to the radio or read the newspaper or magazines or books for shorter and shorter. I think it's a canard. I think people, if you give them interesting material, will devour it. I think there's a great hunger out there for the kind of programming that you hear on WFPL and the kind of programming we try to do at Talk of the Nation and the kind of programming we do at NPR. And I think people really want it. That's one of the great benefits of being in public broadcasting is you're producing material that people, you know, by how they react to it, that people want.
Yeah. What about the personal side of this for you? Because not only as an interviewer, but you're a person, you're a citizen, you're part of a, you know, community. How careful are you of always of separating those two when you step into that booth every day?
Not merely my interest, but it is an NPR's interest, and there is an ethics manual the size of the Manhattan Telephone Directory that explains the things, the principles by which we should undertake our lives. But for example, on a show like Talk of the Nation, where we cover everything, I can't belong to the PTA. I can't belong to AARP because I have to cover them. So there is all kinds of restrictions in what I can and cannot do. I endorse the New York Yankees' efforts to win the American League East, and that's about as far as I can go.
Because you are a baseball fan, which
absolutely.
Is one thing, and I want to get back to that later in this show if we have time. Let's switch gears, though. Everybody's talking about the debates. We have our first debate tomorrow. Mm-hmm. NPR is covering the debates.
Yes.
A lot of people are wondering also right now, what should we expect? Can this actually be a turning point for either candidate? Romney, of course, everybody says he needs this. How are you understanding what's going on right now?
Well, it was interesting. I was talking to Ken Rudin the other day, and we'll be talking more about it tomorrow. But he was saying if according to the polls, the election was really close, this would not be an interesting debate because both sides would be playing it very, very cautiously. You can expect the president to be playing it cautiously because by all measures except one, he's well ahead, all he has to avoid is making some terrible gaffe, some mistake that would enable the game to be changed. Mr. Romney is in a different situation. No, I don't need a turnaround, he said a couple of weeks ago. Reset, in fact, is the word that we keep hearing, and indeed Governor Christie of New Jersey was, I thought, candid, as he usually is, on Meet the Press the other day about the necessity for something that will change the dynamic of the race, because if you look at the polls, at least those that most people believe, Mr. Romney is in difficulties. If he can't win Virginia, Ohio, and Florida, he's not going to win the race, and he's behind in all those states right now.
Right. It seems from the Obama camp, a lot of people are saying right now that he's kind of playing it cool, talking about the debate right now. He says, Romney's a great debater. I've been out of the campaign so much.
Everybody right? tries to play down expectations so that, you know, but the fact is, Mr. Romney did well in the debates in the Republican primaries. He was in the position pretty much of being the front runner. It was interesting, if you go back 4 years when it was Senator McCain who was the front runner and Mitt Romney the challenger, he did not do so well. So it'll be interesting to see what happens then. And Mr. Obama, a wonderful speaker, not necessarily a great debater. You remember the Hillary, you're likable enough, not one of his great moments. He needs to avoid moments like that. Mr. Romney, we're told, is rehearsing zingers. These can work to your benefit. You're no Jack Kennedy. These can work to your detriment. They can backfire. So, but Mr. Romney's got to do something to change the dynamic, and the conversation has to be about something else Thursday morning, or it's going to be getting to go back to baseball and Yogi Berra. It gets late early out there.
You know, earlier I said that we are removed in a sense from presidential politics with the way that Kentucky has been voting, but. However, we are hosting the vice presidential debate at Center College in Kentucky, so that has created some dialogue here. Any sense from you on what we can expect, or will this be a vital part of the campaign, or maybe they're not generally speaking anyway? How do you understand?
Unless pies are exchanged on stage, I don't think this is going to be a focal point of the campaign. This is interesting to those of us who will watch it and pay a lot of attention to it, but you know, barring something really dramatic, no, this will not be a turning point. The next presidential debate then is on foreign policy. I don't think a lot of people are going to be focused on that. The last one is a town hall meeting. There might be some more attention to that, but this first one, tomorrow night, that is the big one.
Yeah. Let's switch gears a little bit to talk about why you're in Louisville today. And you'll be speaking this evening with Steven Pinker of Harvard University. He's the author of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. He's one of the great psychologists right now. And this is, as we were joking, an 832-page book.
Doorstop. Yeah.
That's right. We've seen it all over. And he makes a very, very new, a very, very interesting argument, which is just not to sum it up as quickly as we can, that, you know, the progress of our development in humans is we're becoming more of we're becoming pacifists generally, beginning from when we started as hunter-gatherers to the current day, that our evolution has been one of peace rather than more violence, and we've become more of a peaceful culture. How have you been preparing for this? Have you enjoyed the book?
It is interesting. I've enjoyed the book, but when you're reading for an interview, it's not quite the same as reading a book for pleasure. And so I'm underlining, I'm making notes, I'm dogging pages. It has taken me years to get over the fact that I'm destroying a book
right.
in the process. But I hold them in great reverence. But the process is not quite the same. So I'm thinking about how do I turn this assertion into a conversation, and how do I follow up? Where do I go from here? So that's more or less what I'm doing. And it's not quite the same as, you know, people say, how did you like the book? I don't know.
Right.
You know, I can tell whether it's well written or not. It is well written. It is closely argued. I can see some holes, so there'll be some interesting conversations tonight. I'm much on much surer ground on history than psychology, so I may shift as much with the argument to my preferred ground than to his, but we'll see how it goes.
But you would say that it's a compelling argument.
It is. It's a provocative argument that, in fact, we live in the most peaceful era in human history. And you look at the carnage of the 20th century and you say, how can that possibly be so? What is central to his argument is you have to look at the rates at which people are killed, maimed, injured, and otherwise tortured, rather than the sheer numbers. If you look at the sheer numbers, of course, the 20th century stands out as one of the worst in human history. But if you look at the rates of deaths in battle, if you look at the rates of homicides and other things, he argues that, in fact, this is the most peaceful era in American history. It is counterintuitive, and that's what makes it so interesting.
Well, it seems counterintuitive simply because the 24-hour media cycles, the news that we can't seem to get away from anymore, is one that just seems of endless violence.
And again, part of his argument, and he will make it for himself this evening, is in fact that we romanticize the past and we forget how bloody and terrible the past was, even as little as 50 years ago. when many countries in the world enforce the death penalty. Very few enforce the death penalty anymore. He talks about the civilizing process going back through the Middle Ages, effectively, that the manners of the upper classes filtered first to the courtiers, the middle class, the upper middle class, who had to approach the court in these better organized states that emerged as the result of the Renaissance. And those manners then filtered down throughout the lower classes, and people became kinder to each other in various ways. We're going to start out interesting conversation. I will give you one hint. We're going to start out talking about pushing peas onto your fork with a knife.
Wow. Little did we expect that coming. Well, I was going to just ask you if there are any spoiler alerts you can give us in terms you mentioned that there's a few questions you're going to have for him about.
Oh, I think so, yes. And there are other measures that people don't measure things the same way he does. He does not include some things that people would be angry about. The most interesting parts is the ways that I think for the conversation in which the United States is both an exemplar and an outlier. For example, in murder rates, for example, in the death penalty, and in other respects as well. So it's going to be an interesting conversation.
Well, Neil, we have about 1 minute left together today. And as I said earlier, one thing that people are talking about right now, and your colleague David Green at NPR is baseball everywhere right now.
Absolutely.
And some people might not know that you took a year off to be a baseball announcer in the minor leagues some time ago. Are you still following these things?
Resolutely. David and Don Gagne and Ken and I stop in the hallways with Siegel and argue about this stuff. That's the stuff we really care about. We're professionals about this news business, but baseball is what we truly care about. So Don is very happy that the Detroit Tigers are in. Washington, D.C. has just seen its first baseball playoff team since 1933. So a lot of people there are pretty excited about that. And it's still going down to the wire in the American League East. So we'll have to see where that goes.
Well, Neil Conant, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Jonathan, my pleasure. Nice to see you again.